The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good afternoon. All right. My name is Dr. Guy Sims. I'm the Chief Diversity and Inclusion Officer here at the library, and on behalf of the Free Library, I would like to welcome everyone to today's program. We want to talk about the new illustrated memoir of Dr. Tommy Smith. Joining Dr. Smith are the writer, author Derek Barnes, illustrator Dawood Anubuile, and the facilitator of today's conversation is the award-winning broadcaster and journalist Tracy Matisak. But let me share their biographies in brief. Tommy Smith and John Carlos made history at the 1968 Mexico City Olympics, where they stood at the winner's podium and raised their black gloved fist to protest racial injustice in the United States. Smith, gold medalist in the 200-meter sprint, and Carlos, the bronze medal winner, were forced to leave the games and face a swift and brutal backlash at home. The author of this memoir, Silent Gesture, he coached track and taught sociology at Oberlin College. Smith is an inductee to the United States National Track and Field Hall of Fame and California Black Sports Hall of Fame. Derek Barnes is the author of more than a dozen best-selling children's books that celebrate African-American culture, including The Making of Dr. Truelove, Crown, and Ode to the Fresh Cut, and Ruby and the Booker Boys series. He has been honored with a Newbery Award and a Coretta Scott King Award. Emmy Award-winning illustrator Dawood Anubuile designed storyboards for Cartoon Network, TBS, TNT, and Boomerang. He illustrated the graphic novel adaptation of Walter Dean Meyer's book Monster and is the illustrator of the Brother Man Dictator comic book series, among other projects. His many other honors include an Eisner Award and a Glyph Comics Award. Books are available in the lobby from our bookseller, Uncle Bobby's Coffee and Books, which is located at 5445 Germantown Avenue. So once again, welcome, and I turn the stage over to our esteemed guests. Let's give them a round of applause.
Well, hello, everybody. Thank you so much for joining us here at the Free Library of Philadelphia. And for those of you who are Masterman students, welcome. We are so happy to have you. And you're probably not mad about getting out of school for a little while either. So this is an awesome field trip for you all. If there are other schools that are represented here, we want to welcome everybody. But we're so glad that you could join us for this really important conversation. We want to let you know that after our conversation, the four of us, we have saved some time for your questions for any of our guests. So if you have a question, just raise your hand. We've got staff members with microphones, and they'll come, or probably in a group this size, we may not even need that, but just raise your hand and we'll get through as many questions as we can. So all of that said, it is my great pleasure to welcome Dr. Tommy Smith to the Free Library of Philadelphia. And of course, Derek Barnes, who worked with him on the book, on the writing of the book. And Dawood Anubuile, who illustrated the book. I had to practice that, I want you to know.
Yeah.
So welcome to you all. Thank you so much for being with us and for putting this book out into the world. Dr. Smith, I want to start with you, and I want to start in the year 1968, which was an incredibly turbulent year for this country. You had the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. You had the assassination of Bobby Kennedy not long after that. You had a pandemic. You had civil rights protests. You had Vietnam War protests. There was so much going on. And at that time, you're preparing to go to the Olympics. But even as early as 1967, you and other black athletes were prepared to boycott the Olympics if it came down to it. And I'd like for you to take us back to that time and give us a sense of what was happening that made all of you so willing to potentially even sit out the Olympics if it felt like that was the right thing to do.
We thought sacrifice was an option that we had to take to suspend ignorance of those who believe the equality was a thing that shouldn't happen. It was time for the athletes, especially the black athletes, to stand up in unison for a right which the Constitution had already granted, but we were not given. And we didn't speak very much while competing because competition was our first option coming to, second option actually, the education process was the first, but competition, so we competed, especially this young, very quiet guy here, competed. That was my way of setting a standard for oneself to do what was necessary for any human being that was concerned about a country to grow and go forward. This was our way of communicating with not just the San Jose community, but the entire world. They wanted to hear, so we wanted to tell them, and that's how the story got started.
And you mentioned San Jose. You went to San Jose State, Speed City. We know what was going on in the country, but what was going on more closely for you and for other black athletes that you were willing to potentially make that sacrifice?
Survival, and to send a message that here we are ready, we're committing ourselves, in fact, our lives to the success of equality. And the youth of this country, the young folks, they needed a platform to stand on. So I not only ran for them, but I also stood on the victory stand for the young generation and the world as a whole, suspending everything else but what we, the information, the story we had to tell, and we had to stand up under the pressures of the entire world in a positive manner because there was so much negativity out there toward us, viewing us as bandits instead of those who are putting our lives on the line for the success of equality and what it can preserve in perpetuity.
Want to rewind to the late 1940s in rural Texas, where you were born. You had 11 brothers and sisters, and your parents were sharecroppers. If we were to go back to that time, what would a day in your life have looked like back then?
I don't know where to start, at the beginning or the end of the question, but it's a very complicated situation. Times that then for a family of that size was very difficult. And when you stay in a little shack with all those brothers and sisters, with seven sisters and four brothers, it was kind of difficult. So we had three little shacks once we moved to California just to survive, just to move forward. And that was the legacy of the Smith family then, is to maintain the gratitude of the Most High and to do what we could to create an avenue for growth of us and growth of people. And we had a plethora of families that came on those old gray dingy buses from the fields of Texas to the fields of California. And that was that legacy for me to move proactively forward. Even as a little kid, you know, my ears sticking out side of my head like little antenna, as you said it in the book. But we were proud to do so because we had no other choice.
And you worked in the fields all the time. I mean, your schooling for your early years was rather limited because you had to be in the fields helping to work. You didn't have plumbing. You didn't have so much of what we take for granted now.
We had nothing really but our lives, our God-given possessions, our lives, and our love for people, and especially our families. And yes, picking cotton, chopping cotton, cutting grapes, irrigating, hay baling. Some of you folks out there know what some of these things are. Some of you out there don't know what the heck is this man talking about. But we did it all. We had to do it all. Go to school during the day and work from 6 p.m. to 6 a.m. in the morning in the fields when the night irrigation was necessary. I, at 12 years old, worked with my dad because I was, 6 to 5'11", I guess, at that time, so I could get man's pay. You know, that was big. It was $12 a night for 12 hours. But going to school, either walking from work to home or riding in this old bus, old pickup my dad had, which I could run fast and it could go at top speed, just to get home to catch the bus to go to school all day long. Then football, basketball, a track practice after school. When that finished, me and Daddy, I would meet my dad at home on the front porch. He'd be waiting for me. Told me, boy, let's go to work. I just came from school, tired, sweating, hungry. I didn't have the best perfume in the world, so you know what was next. And that's how we survived.
Yeah.
And the love of the family.
Yeah.
Love of the family and each other.
Derek, I'd like to ask how you and Dr. Smith came to collaborate on this project to begin with.
This is in 2018. I was at the American Library Association Conference in New Orleans, and my agent took me around to different publishing houses in the conference hall, and we had to be about 60 yards away from the W.W. Norton booth. Simon Boughton is out there. He's the publisher, and she just asked me, just out of the blue, "You think you want to write a book about Dr. Tommy Smith?" I was like, "Sure." So we went up to the booth and I shook his hand, and that was it for me. But I think this is probably my 15th book, and I am very conscious of my body of work and what I want to leave behind, and I write intentionally to uplift the beauty and the brilliance of Black children. I'm unapologetically do that, So this book just fit perfectly into my wheelhouse. In order to tell this man's story, it's been a privilege. I was able to go down to his house. I think I've been over twice. I brought my family over the second time. We have four boys. So my second eldest boy, he was at a football camp, and we just stopped by, and he made sandwiches for us and everything. Well, that was pretty awesome. But the first time I came by, stayed all day. His lovely wife made lunch, and I sat down in his man cave. It's galleries. It's like a small museum. Just fan art, trophies, medals, pictures of dignitaries from all over the world, famous athletes, and I just took notes, just sat at his feet, took notes. We had a great conversation. He and I have a lot in common as far as personality goes. He's very laid back, calm, thoughtful person. And just had a good time. I left there. I couldn't believe it. It was pitch black. I just left Tommy Smith's house, man. And I had a full notebook, and I was ready. I was ready to get going. So now I have to think about the... how was I going to tell his story? Was it going to be in verse? Was it going to be a straight novel? But the graphic novel idea just seemed so perfect, because I'm talking about a man who was once the fastest man on the planet, and the graphic novel format just seemed perfect. I had never written a graphic novel before, so it was a challenge for me, but I was up for it. And I see a lot of you have the copies in your hand. Hopefully we did a good job. God willing, we did a good job. So, yeah.
Well, you found the right graphic artist in Dude.
Yes, sir.
And Dude,
Philly's own. Philly's own. Y'all give him some love, man.
So how did the process work for you, Dawood? Were you involved during the writing of the book, or do you get the manuscript and then think about what illustrations you want to add to it? How does that work?
For this project, I came in when the manuscript was already done. Derek actually... recommended me for the project, and so when I came on board, I got to read through the manuscript a couple times, and then I do a first set of like storyboard roughs where I go through it, and then I'll still go back and I'll talk to Derek about if I have certain questions, like, hey, how do you see this scene, and we're both open, it's like I'm open to his opinion, and sometimes he says, hey, if you got a better idea, you can run with it. So then that kind of like alleviates pressure of feeling like, am I doing this right? And then also I got to go to Dr. Smith's house, because I live in Stone Mountain, Georgia now. I've been there for like 22 years now. And I got to stop by Dr. Smith's place and also go down and check out his archives. And I got a taste of his history and his life and, and to talk to him. personally, because, you know, it's one thing when you know you're drawing, because I do like a lot of animation. My background is animation, comics, graphic novels, and even storyboards for film and television. But it's one thing when you're doing projects for that, you know, that are made up, and then you're doing a biopic on somebody's life, and then you're doing somebody, you know, they're here, so they can say, hey, that ain't my life, you know. So that you had that added pressure. Because I had recently done Becoming Muhammad Ali, mm-hmm. but it was about his childhood. But, of course, he's not here now, yeah. so it was an honor to do it. But I couldn't get his perspective.
Yeah.
But with Dr. Smith, you know, that was really, if I was to talk about anybody's opinion, I wanted to know how did he feel about it. Because
yeah.
To me, I'm going to put in my best effort to tell his story based on the things that he shared with me. Yeah. And we're dealing with another era of time, you know, that was before me. So I tell him, you know, I had to, I channel anyway when I draw, but I call this one really was spiritual channeling, you know, because I always consider myself a conduit.
Yeah.
And I pull from things from my ancestors, because his story, I feel like, is my story.
Yeah.
So that's why I was able to feel the characters and the scenarios and the situations, and I just put that into the story.
Dr. Smith, let's fast forward to 1968. October, you've decided that you are going to Mexico City, yeah. but there's still the possibility of maybe a protest of some sort, but nobody's quite sure what it's going to look like. Let's start with you in the starting block, the finals of the men's 200 meters. Take us back to that moment. You're in the starting block. The gun goes off. What happens?
Explosion. Folks, let me tell you. That was my whole life. I worked all those years, cotton fields, cold nights, irrigation in the San Joaquin Valley, all the way through high school to college. And that race, my whole life, that was it. But just before that race, the race before, I had injured my leg severely, a groin muscle area in my left leg, which was my power leg. So once we got in the block area for the 200-meter finals, and I was injured, I was afraid to do my warm-up because I was afraid I would not only just injure that muscle again, but actually destroy it, pull it, mm-hmm. because of the power I had and the fortitude I had to win the race. I had trained to win. I don't like to lose. I don't care what race it is. It's fun, yeah. Even more fun when you win. That was my battle. I'm 6 feet 4 inches tall, same height I was, and standing there with my hands on my hip, and you saw the picture, just looking at these powerful world-class athletes taking their practice starts, and Tommy Smith, the world record holder, standing there looking at them, and I couldn't practice start. So the challenge just grew in me. What am I going to do, Lord? You put me here, Lord, now. Come on, man, help me out. This was, I'm talking to myself, I can remember like yesterday. And when he said, think about this, you're in the blocks. Your whole life is in front of you, everything. Mama, daddy, 11 brothers and sisters watching somewhere. Here is their brother in the blocks. The starter said, on your marks. Get set. In nanoseconds, my whole life, zip, went right through my body. But I could not forget the first thing that a sprinter needs to know is the first three steps. And being 6 feet four, I was traumatized because I was so long that I had to get out with a pull muscle as fast as I could to get in front of John Carlos, Peter Norman, Larry Quistad, and the rest of them. And guess what place I was in when I came out the blocks and found out that this is it? I was in the fourth place. I'm never in fourth place coming out of the block, coming off the turn. And as I came off the turn and straightened up, John Carlos was out in front of me, reading the Bible to everybody. And I said, okay, John, I'm going to take Hebrew 11:1, faith. And I lift up, you can see it in the race, and I just release all the emotions. And it was like fourth gear in a five-gear car. It just went by everybody. And I said, I told you so, like a little kid, and I went all the way back. I told you I was going to do it. And 6-8 meters from the finish line. I did what sprinters, if you are in here, you never do. Throw your arms up. You're in a race to finish. Finish the race with pride, justice, and authenticity. That was it. I know I probably went over time, but that's that was it, that race. Yeah. And those feet.
And you did it all in 19.83 seconds.
Yes, ma'am.
So, right after that, what happened next was something that you describe as planned spontaneity. As I said, there was the possibility of some sort of protest, but take us back to that moment when you and John Carlos were about to receive your medals. You're thinking about how are we going to, you know, get our message across. What did you do in that moment?
John and I had talked about it a few minutes before. The Olympic Project for Human Rights was a great platform of a lot of different things. And the OPHR, which is the Olympic Project for Human Rights, under this, within this platform. And we had to make sense of what everyone else in the world didn't know because we hadn't told anybody anything. But we had a message. The boycott was called off because a lot of the things we had on the boycott list to be done before we competed, if we competed, it was done. And when we walked out on the track, we had already discussed the black socks representing poverty, the black glove represents power, not necessarily black power, but social power, power to move forward uniformly with justice. Nobody heard us before that race, and we had did finished a lot of talking to the medias about the necessary things that needed to be done in the world of sports, especially track and field. But no one did say anything. So we thought it necessary to make a justified plea one more time to the world about the need for justice to be identified. And the Olympic Project for Human Rights victory stand was the final act, and that was not of hate, but of pride, justice, and power. Yes, we were black. People call it the Black Power sign. I call it the Olympic Project for Human Rights, not black rights, not Hispanic rights, not any other but everybody. Not any other but everybody. And that's what the Olympic Project stand on the victory stand was about, the unity of those who believe that there are subhumans, and there's this thing as a subhuman. We're all human on the same, that we've created that way. If you think of any other way, you're wrong.
So in the course of 80 seconds, your entire life changed after you raised your fist. The backlash was pretty quick. Your lives changed immensely after that time. Talk about the price that you paid for making that gesture.
Price was loss. It was a classified loss within a society of two young black men who did what we did to propagate a foundation that was necessary for us to move on, not only in athletics, but as a unified social structure called America. And we did it gladly. We put our lives on the line just to do that. And it's illustrated very well in, from page 170 on to 204, I think it's in the book. So when we dedicated that race to the world, and we made it very appropriate by the thought press of viewing, because we had no time to talk. And yes, it was probably 80 seconds. Mm-hmm. And during that 80 seconds, I prayed the whole time. I heard the sound, but I prayed the whole time because I was afraid I was gonna get blown off that victory stand by some sniper hidden in the stands, mm-hmm. because our lives has been threatened so many times before we got to Mexico. Then when we got to Mexico, we realized that how many Mexican students were killed because they stood up for human rights just before we got there. So what would you think? Mexican student blood still laying on the street, and we're walking, looking at it, and wondering, oh, are we going to be laying there as well? So there's a lot of things on a young 24-year-old's mind who had a six-month-old son and a wife that I would leave vacant because I put up my life. Like Dr. Martin Luther King had only been killed 6 months before. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we can go on and talk about this, but I'll quit now so these young minds over here can sojourn with me on this.
Yeah. Yeah, and in terms of the loss in the immediate aftermath, I mean, you lost your job, your marriage fell apart. You and John Carlos were swiftly sent back to the United States, and not to a hero's welcome, but to quite the opposite. And then, my understanding is that the FBI had been watching you all for quite a long time.
Yeah, I giggle at this because they were all the time. Even my first job at Oberlin College, where I became a professor at 27 years old, they followed me there, found me in a barbershop in the neighborhood. In Oberlin, the town was only 5,700, and the college was bigger than the town. So they found me across the railroad track. Yeah, I know. Guys, ladies, I had hair then, okay? So I was cutting my hair, and I'm sitting there chilling, and I saw this raggedy old car passing two or three times with a little sneaky antenna sticking out of the trunk. So I knew it was more than me and my brother walking down the street with an antenna that stuck up, you know. And so the car stopped beside my old car, which was a 57 Beverdale Plymouth. And they got out, looked into the car, and as they bent over, I can see that there was more under their coat than a belt holding their pants up because of the bulge that came out. So they looked at the barbershop and they came over. I said, oh my God, here, gosh. And the people in the barbershop didn't know who I was sitting there. So they came in the back door. And they opened the door. And, is there a Tommy Smith in here? Yeah, I'm cool. Sitting there. And everybody looked around. Well, Tommy Smith. And he said, I said, can you hear me? Is there a Tommy Smith in the room? So I had to vindicate their idea of being shot. So I said, I'm Tommy Smith. They asked me, could you come outside? We want to talk to you. I said, no, not right now. I'm getting a haircut. Meet me back at my office in a half an hour. I didn't tell them where. So when I got back to my office, they were sitting at my door. I opened my door and said, gentlemen, come on in. So I went and sat at my desk, propped my feet up on my desk, cut my coleus plants. I'm a plant green thumb. I clipped my coleus plant, and I said, what do you guys want? He said, well, we want to know a few things, Mr. Smith. Do you know a person by the name of Patty Hearst? Okay, there's a long story behind that, and he told it in the book. So I told him, no, I know where she's from. I know what she's noted for, but she hasn't come to this office. Well, why Patty Hearst? Because the person who hired me knows Patty Hearst very well. So he came to see me because he wasn't there. They had fired him already. So we talked for about half an hour, and I told him a bit of my history, bit of my coleus plant that was sitting behind me. After about 15 minutes, they got up. Thank you, sir. We need somebody like you in our league. I said, well, thank you very much, but I have one. Mm-hmm. So that was it.
Yeah.
Basically, you know, but there are a few other things, but I can't tell you the words we used.
Can you clarify, Dr. Smith, did they take your medals or were you allowed to keep them?
We were not allowed to keep them. We kept them anyway.
Just stuck them in your suitcase and
no, we didn't hide them. We told them no way. We ran the race. We did nothing wrong. Why you want to take our medals? Yeah. And they had really no courageous answer. They had sneaky answers like, "Well, we believe that you will get them back, but we just want to take them to show people that the need of." And John, I gave the phone to John Carlos after that. We can't say what John said either. Some of you know John, and yeah, right. So, no, they threatened us, of course, especially Douglas Roby, who was the president of the USOC, United States Olympic Committee. And we wondered why he did. He said the IOC, which is the International Olympic Committee, told him if he didn't, they would disqualify the rest of the track and field team. Yeah. Yeah. So we kept our medals, and we still have our medals, and my medal is in the state I was born. Where I pick cotton, chop cotton, all that stuff, mm-hmm. My medal is in that state. Yeah. And that is the state of what, wife? Clarksville, okay. Texas. Just so as you want y'all to hear her voice.
Yeah. So, Dr. Smith, after all those years of loss and the heavy price that you all paid for standing up in that way, somewhere around 2000, the tide begins to turn. And now all of a sudden people are viewing that event in a different way, yeah. And they're seeing the two of you in a different way. What changed?
The turmoil of the 60s was a rallying point for people to understand that there was a need for change. All the assassination, the bombing of babies in churches, police brutality, knees on parts of the body that should not have been because it choked people to death, and certain other things you said right in the book. So you, that you have to read. It's all itemized. And just social change, time for social change because of so many social things that was happening, and people begin to understand that I have a voice, meaning you have a voice, and you needed to be unrestrained by keeping quiet because silence is not an option. If you want something done, you have to open your mouth and do it yourself. Let me ask you a question. How many times have you been in a conversation and wanted to say something, but you were afraid that you'd be laughed at because of the way you talk or the way you looked or the answer you give? But that is not what to be thought of. Answer the question. Don't wait until you have to say, oh, I should have spoke. I should have answered it. I knew the answer there. I should have said something. It's too late. So young folks, speak up. Silence is not an option. Speak your piece. Smile. Oh, you don't have to smile while you're doing it, but do more than sit there and be identified as calm. Say something and stand up behind your answer to whatever you say. Don't be silent. I mean, I can go over and over that again. You folks that over an age limit know what I'm talking about. If you want to be heard, silence won't do it.
Time is getting away from us quickly, and I do have a few more questions for you, Dr. Smith, and also I'm coming back, Derek and DeWoo, to you as well. But Dr. Smith, before we move on, I wonder what you were thinking as you watched Colin Kaepernick and Eric Reed and, you know, modern-day athletes taking a knee and making their own form of protest that was so reminiscent of what you did in 1968.
They had a platform. They used a platform to, again, move toward more, actually it was a tranquil way of letting the system know that, yes, I am somebody I will do to help whomever I can. I will sacrifice to do just this. This is why, and they gave their reasons why. Folks, have a reason for every move you make. So when you answer it, you'll answer with some solidified question so people can understand that you can communicate. Young folks, communicate. Communication through education. Understand that. Don't be afraid. Don't sit in the back of the room and wish you had to sit in the front so you could hear the teacher, so you would have got a C on the test instead of an F. Don't want to get off too far because I forget the question here. Real quick, I forget the question. What was the question?
So we were talking about Colin Kaepernick, yeah, and just watching, yeah, athletes take a stand.
I've talked to Colin a few times about that. Eric, not too much, but Colin, and he said that he did what he thought he should do. He was born, raised in the same area I was in California. So we knew the plight there were there where we lived and all over the world. You know, the man played professional football for 7 years, I think, won one Super Bowl, and so he saw a lot of things in his sport that needed to be touched upon. And he used that. You know, he was on his knees more than just that one time, but he was not recognized until other athletes started doing what he was doing. Then the cameras caught guys on their knees. Again, they were pariahs, the media, because they wanted the first chance to make news. And, of course, like in 1968, the writers of the story first were very negative of what they were doing because negativism made big news then, especially if it was a black athlete doing something to identify the needs of a system to change its ways because the 60s were definitely the time of social change with the president's murder and Dr. King and et cetera. It went through the whole realm of murders during the 60s, and that's but so Colin and Eric, they caught on, and other athletes too. Look at the athletes now who are talking about certain issues, which is very important, and that's the push of this book. And Eric here did a what's your name is Eric, isn't it? Oh, Derek. I know. That wasn't funny at all. I'm just a human being, folks, just like you or IWG. I got a few world records and a few stuff in my name, but I'm just like anybody else, doing what I think is necessary to grow a system proactively. So I'm going to let y'all think of the other things I got to say and move on to the other guys here.
Well, a couple quick questions before we turn it over to our audience. Derek, we may have some aspiring writers in our audience. You've written a number of books. What advice would you have for someone who might consider following in your footsteps?
When I graduated, I'm a graduate of probably the greatest HBCU in the country, Jackson State University. My first job was I wrote greeting cards for Hallmark cards, and there were some lifers there, people who have worked there for 30, 40 years, talented illustrators, writers. And one of the things that the, you know, editorial staff really pushed was that we work on, you know, developing our voice. And your voice is your writing style, that if there were no names on the cover of the book and, you know, a reader picked up a book, they would be able to tell that it was your story, it was your writing style that was being used. So I really started working on my cadence, working on my voice, but most importantly, when I got into the publishing industry, I found that as a black man and as a black writer, it's really important that you figure out your audience. Who are you writing for? And I think a lot of times, you know, we just want to get put on. We just want to get land that big contract. And that's not so important. Again, going back to what I was saying earlier, your body of work is what's most important. My greatest legacy is my wife and my four sons. But from an artistic standpoint, when I'm done here, when I'm no longer writing, I want people to say, he really tried to say something. And so you have to think about your audience. What are you trying to say? Who are you writing for? I think that all artists have a obligation, you know, to humanity. But if you're a black artist in this country, you have no other choice but to be an activist, whether you're an illustrator, a musician, an actor, you are an activist just by the sheer nature that you were born black in this country. And so, you know, develop your voice. Read everything that you can get your hands on. I read constantly. I'm constantly trying to get better. I think that's another thing we have. And, you know, he'll try to beat everybody down the steps or, you know, to the dinner table. Very competitive. You know, I am still trying to, you know, develop my voice, still trying to get better. I read a lot just to see what different writers use different devices and kind of weave it into my style. I'm a huge music fan, so I think my style is very lyrical, but you have to figure out what your voice is going to be. So read everything that you can get your hands on and write every single day. I write every day, whether it's a love letter to my wife or it's you know, the next few pages in a book that I'm working on. I'm working on three projects right now. Writers write. I mean, so many people that want to be published authors, and they haven't written a word. They think this is like a lottery. You know what I mean? You know, being an artist is like, but it's not that way at all. I struggled for a long time before things popped off for me, but until I figured out who my audience was and who I was writing for, man, I feel so blessed to get up every morning to do what I do. Amen. Every single morning, so.
And Dawood, before we go to our audience, your advice for maybe we've got some graphic artists in our audience.
Yeah, well, I guess my advice is to just keep working on your craft. And I think that's anything in life. I mean, as long as you're alive, you can be 15, you could be 50, you could be 75, 80. You know, as long as you can breathe and you're functional, you're always going to be a student. So there's never really a point where it's like, hey, I arrived, I know everything, I can stop now, I don't need to learn anything else. You know, life is going to be a there's all things are going to keep changing, adjusting, shifting. So you're always going to want to, you know, just stay up on things. And one thing I would say, too, is do what you love. You know, I always tell people, you know, live your love, you know, because you can say, hey, I'm doing this to make some money. And, you know, money is necessary because that's the tool to help you navigate through life. But also you want to do something that you when you get up in the morning, it's like, regardless if I'm getting paid or not, this is what I want to do. This is what I enjoy. And what happens is other people, they see the love in what you do, and then they want to share in your love. So they give you money. And that's usually how the money comes, from you doing what you love. You know what I mean? So I would just say continue doing that. And also think about your circle. The people that are around you, do they hold you up? Do they say good things to you? Or do they clown you? Do they say, oh, man, you trying to still do this thing? Or, you know, or just say they don't say nice things to you. Then you got to really separate yourself from that. That's regardless if they're friends, family, or whatever. You got to get around people that hold you up and you feel like they're on your team, because that's really going to play a part on your psyche and how you feel about yourself, and that's what helps you in the long run. Yeah.
So that said, thank you for such great advice. Let's. Let's take some questions from our audience for our guests. Oh, good. We have a bunch.
Great. First, I'm just hyped, so I'm going to try to control myself. I want to thank you brothers for doing this work. This is amazing. I want to thank the library. This is absolutely fantastic. I'm so thrilled. I'm Dr. Richard Cooper, Widener University co-coordinator, African American Studies.
Fantastic.
If I could have brought busloads of my students to get here, I would have paid for it out of my pocket. I just couldn't get it done. The question that I have is two things. In the area of consciousness, a lot of times we don't associate consciousness with athletes or black athletes, and I'm wondering if you could speak to that, and then if the other two brothers could speak to attempting to get this information as you have to a younger audience and how important that is. Thank you.
Sitting at the back of the classroom is one of the worst things you can do. I mean, I'm going right off of the synopsis of what the question was. Do your best no matter what it is, and like I said, silence is not an option. I've taught grammar school for many years, college for 33 years, and my whole platform is stop, look, and listen, and then communicate. You know, don't do it because your buddy did it. Do it from your heart, and do it because it's a necessity to learn. Abide by the will of oneself, S-E-L-F, self. Build yourself. Build a monument from the inside out. That's where all the stuff is in the egg. It's on the inside, not that hard shell.
Would one of you like to take the other question, which was about the importance of getting this information to young audiences? Derek?
I think it's important to use, you know, mediums that they are familiar with. You know, there's no reason to try to recreate the wheel. These graphic novels became extremely popular, I guess, like 15 years ago, maybe. They started taking, you know, middle grade novels and making them into, you know, graphic novels. And like I said, his story just seemed to fit perfectly with that, you know, format. Graphic novels, I mean, you know, novels in verse have become extremely palatable, you know, because they are able to give a story in these small poetic bites. So I'm a true believer in meeting children where they are and not trying to force them to, force information on them. But there are so many ways to get information to children if you just meet them on their level. So
I have to be honest, I don't have a question. But I come here to pay homage to an individual who has put his life on the line for the rest of us. I'm 90 years old and have been in the struggle since the early 50s. And I know the story that you just told. I've studied the Olympics of 1968 because I've had some friends who were involved. I'm not going to name them, but I got some. And I'm not too proud of what the stands that they took. But I have always, always admired you and John for your determination, for your courage, and for your struggle for the people. You didn't stand on that stand for John Carlos and and yourself. You stood that's up right. there for all the rest of us. That's what the struggle is all about. I'm so thankful that I lived long enough to see you face to face to tell you that. And I'm hoping that I can do the same for John someday.
We have some questions here in the middle. Yes.
Dr. Smith, you paid a tremendous price. You, John Carlos, and to a certain extent, Peter Norman. Can you tell us how you actually survived the backlash after the 68 Olympics? Thank you.
Not giving up. Always on the move for mankind, regardless of male, female, people. And the educational process had to be, for me, one of the biggest motivators for me to move on, because I could teach from my heart that God gave me to the younger generations behind me, because that's future America. And I had to do what I had to do because I wasn't me. I was used as a tool for him to ask for others to understand, and the only way I had was to show as many people as I could on that victory stand. And most people that I know around the world don't know me, but if you hold a fist up, then they will know. They will know where it came from. And most will know that message, like the people here now. You will know that stand was not a stand for hate. It was a signal of hope for hope, and generations to follow understand that. Talk to yourself in the mirror. Talk to yourself in the mirror. Try to hate yourself in the mirror. You can't do that. I want you to feel that way with the person who's not in the mirror that you see actually with your eyes that God gave you. You young folks, talk to an old person every once in a while. They have a story. They have a story. This man is 90 years old here. Did you say 90 or 25? And he's still out there hoping, sustaining an effort of survival for a generation, generations to come. That's the only way this world is going to come under a flag of continual hope. We shall overcome is not an option to forget. We are still overcoming. You go, you think you've overcome. No, just turn to the next page and overcome it too. Just continue. Don't quit. Now, but I'm going to quit right now.
Yes, the young man in the white hoodie.
Hi. My name is Owen Erdman. I'm a sophomore at Masterman. And before I ask my question, I just wanted to thank you for coming out. And it's been such an honor to hear you guys speak today. So your powerful act in the 1968 Summer Olympics showed your strong support of the Black Power movement, which was partially inspired by Kwame Ture, who was formerly known as Stokely Carmichael, an extremely important figure in the civil rights movement. So my question is, how did you perceive Stokely Carmichael as a civil rights activist and as a person? Was he someone you looked up to? And if so, why?
That's a question I can ask. You want to answer that for me, or you want me to take that one?
Yeah, I forgot what year. This is 1967, and it was in Oakland. He went to a forum. It was a meeting of Black activists. There were athletes, and I think Brother Stokely was there, but you know, Dr. King was there.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Bill Russell, you know, members of the Black Panther Party, and there were members of Speed City there, and so this preceded the 1968 Olympics, and they were just trying to formulate a plan of action. Dr. Smith is, again, a very thoughtful person. He is just a perfect listener. He's not the kind of person that's going to be in the center of the room. So that everyone was up speaking. You have all these great, you know, orators speaking. He's in the back of the room absorbing everything. I feel like that meeting was a catalyst for you to actually end up doing what you end up doing. I mean, being in the same room with Dr. King and Stokely Carmichael and A-Trap Brown and, you know, Bill Russell and all these brothers were there, and he was in the back of the room absorbing all that energy. Yep. And yep, a year later,
yeah,
the Olympics happened.
It was like a gas tank filling station stop for me. I filled up on things that I could use to move on down the line. And it fueled my effort because I saw these guys, a little bit older than I, but they were there talking about a system which did not represent them. And Carmichael, he was a great spokesperson, as you already know, because you did research on him. And he accounted for the need to move forward. Just say something. What did John Lewis say? Thank you. Good trouble. It's going to be trouble anyway. Make yours good. Make sure you speak up. Speak up. Get that hand up. Speak up. Get out of that back row of life and move to the front with pride. Don't prop your feet up on your desk, though. You can just cross them and keep on down the line.
I have to say the same thing as the gentleman, the 90-year-old, that I wish to say thank you. Thank you. I was doing that era here in Philadelphia and saw it. When you and John Carlos did it, it empowered, you know, as you said, it's a symbol of Black power, but it empowered us, my group of friends and associates, and what it did, it almost like said to us, support the NAACP. And Cecil B. Moore, I don't know if you know him, he was the head of the NAACP. And we went out there and we marched, especially around Girard College. So it was an inspiration. You just don't know that we admire you and John when you did it. And you know, back then it was during the Vietnam War too. So we had a lot of things going on back there in the 60s, which I think was the best decade that I ever experienced. And I want to say again, thank you again for that courage that God spoke to you and you were obedient to his words. And he protected you. And he's going to continue to protect you. And for any of these young people, if you feel as though you want to take a stand, please take a stand. And I'd like to ask this question. Is John still upon this earth?
Is he still what?
John, yeah. Carlos. Yeah, talk about, are you in touch with him still?
When it's necessary.
Thank you.
Know. Yeah, yeah. John is from Harlem, New York. Mm-hmm. And I'm from the backwoods of Texas. Mm-hmm. So we're both very intimate with the moving of a nation, especially a nation that needs help. Mm-hmm. And this is one of those nations. Pride, yes, but I'm proud of who I am and where I am, where I live. But I'm also proud that I have been given the strength and the blessings to move forward, to appreciate by helping anyone who will listen, especially the young group. That's why I majored in social sciences in college. I wanted to be a school teacher. I started teaching school in the fifth grade. Of course, they ran me out. You know, then I went on to another echelon, ended up at Oberlin College mm-hmm. as an instructor there. But that's what we did. That's what else I can say. That Daddy taught me. Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh, see, my wife always keeps me clean.
Yeah, she's keeping me on track.
Yeah, right. Yeah, John is still alive.
Very much alive.
Yeah, very much alive. Yeah. Give him the mic and he'll tell you.
Very proud. When we saw you on TV, everybody's hand went up. We were hollering out the door. You guys are an inspiration. And I will say that when you're involved with activism, everybody's not for you. And that's something our kids have to learn. Here in Philadelphia, I'm with the Cecil B. Moore Philadelphia Freedom Fighters here in Philadelphia. People were against us trying to break the will to get black children into a college, a free school for young people. And like I said, we're so proud of you. You don't know what you've done. But I do have a question. Oh, the graphic novel, I just looked through it. Great. And there's a graphic novel here from the Bloxon Collection called Blam, Black Lives Always Matter. They were trying to get to all of the school children, the high schools here in Philadelphia. And that's a graphic novel about a lot of people in Philadelphia that people don't talk about. You just made me think of it when I saw the book here. Excellent. And I just browsed through it today. The question I have is, when George Foreman got up and waved that flag around the ring, did you guys talk about that?
Yeah, we did. We talked about it. We wanted to run and grab George, but you know, Georgia's side would not permit us running and grabbing. I met George not very long ago in a platform we had with me and Joe Green and all those people. I talked to you earlier about that a bit. And I said, George. And he kind of turned and looked at me and said, man, what you want? I said, the flag. He said, that I did what I thought was necessary. I did what I thought. I said, what are you going to do with it? He said, I'm going to use it to let people know why I did what I did. But he didn't do much more than just that. He's still George in his own way of being George. But George had a lot more pressure on him by his own folks. As you said, just because they're your color, that don't mean that they're your friend, okay? He said, what I did, I knew what I was doing because mostly I was told what to do. You know, and you can bounce off of that any way you want, but we just got had different personalities.
Owen, I'm also a student visiting from Aspen. I want to say it's an honor to hear you speak today, and I respect you and thank you for doing what you did. You said that you had an injury on your left leg. I just wanted to ask, how was that? Like, how did you treat your injury, and how were you treated as a Black Olympic athlete in the medical field? And if there were any other experiences that stood out to you then?
I think I understood it. Let me try to answer what I understood.
The question was about being in the Olympics when he had the groin injury, and how were Black athletes treated in the medical environment at the Olympics?
Well, being an athlete there, the most highest game that you can be in any sport that you're in, for us, it was the Olympic Games, and of course, we had trainers there. But thankfully, my college coach was also there, and he had treated us when I was at San Jose State. So when he saw me almost fall to the ground, he knew that Tommy was injured, because I never did fake anything. Don't believe in faking. So I knew it was a groin injury because of where it was. I thought I had been shot, but I hope that where it hit, that he could have made better aim, you know. So they took me to the training room, and I knew that it was a ligament injury and not a muscle injury. So we iced it to keep the blood out of that area. And when time came to run, then we warmed it up quickly, and we walked across the track, and I got in the race. That's why I didn't warm up, because I wanted to keep it isolated and blood out of that area as possible. So when I needed it, that's when I wanted to explode in that area, and that was 20 meters from the finish, but the next day I couldn't walk. Mm. Had it been for God, he knows what he's doing, okay? That's what my faith was. Hebrews 11:1, faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen, but without work, faith is dead. So that's my power.
Hi, I'm Mizel. I'm also a Masterman student in 10th grade. And I just wanted to thank you again for coming and speaking to all of us, because it's been a very inspirational speech to all of us young people, I'd say. And you said a lot of important things. And the question I had was that when you were in the Olympics in 1968, since you had mentioned that there was the student protest where they were shot because of my grandfather who was in that protest, I know that he spoke about how he felt connected to you in your issues in African-American the fight for civil rights. So I wanted to ask you, did you feel any connection to the students in 1968 during the Olympics in Mexico?
Oh, of course. Very good question. Of course we did. One of the first things we did, we wanted to find out where it happened. Of course, we were forbidden in most cases, but John and Tommy are very persistent young individuals at the time. And they had painted over, they had painted some buildings around it. Yes, they sacrificed because they were fighting for the same thing in their country as we were fighting in our country, which is the agility in mind to think and believe that equity would solve a lot of the problems. And the Mexican government said, no, you don't do this. We have too many people coming in our country here in our city to view these electrifying games. And they sacrifice a lot of their young people just so the world would think that they are on the side of equality or equitability. And I was told this by a Mexican council, not just Tommy Smith making up something.
So before we go, there's been this rumor floating around about you and John Carlos possibly lighting the cauldron at the 2028 Olympics in Los Angeles. Is there any truth to that?
Well, I don't know. Why, if there any truth to that?
I was reading an article about it today, as a matter of fact, that there's some people who think that you two would be the perfect people to light the cauldron at the 2028 Olympics. Wow.
Yeah, I gotta, you know, I'll be almost 90 then myself, okay?
So if I'm Don't strong, let that stop you. Well, please, audience, join me in thanking Dr. Tommy Smith, Derek Barnes, Arud Anivire for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.